What if Europe's problem is not spending too much,
but in fact, lending too much?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, April 30th.
Coming up, the relationship between expensive soybeans and the global rice crop.
And a report from the feds takes aim at Google.
Plus, what's the tallest building in New York? The answer will be different depending on when you answer that today.
It's all just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
Spain chopped its budgets, but now austerity is biting back. There's word today that Spain's economy is now going backwards, that it's contracting at an annual rate of about half of 1%. This is not healthy and has contributed to a new sense that Europe has failed to contain its financial crisis caused by countries that wildly spent borrowed money.
And to make matters worse for Spain, Standard & Poor's has downgraded the credit rating on 11 Spanish banks, making it harder for those banks to borrow money. Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us now from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
So is Spain the new Greece?
Well, actually, Spain is different from Greece in a couple of important ways. One, Spain is a whole lot bigger than Greece. And secondly, Spain doesn't have a package of assistance yet. So we worry about Spain being able to implement austerity and grow. Clearly, that's not working. They've slipped into recession. But they don't yet have any help from the Eurozone to get through this crisis.
Well, isn't that what that giant bailout fund is for, though, to help countries that end up in trouble?
Absolutely. And the good news is there is plenty of firepower in the bailout fund. But we basically Spain has to ask for help. And a newly elected government isn't really eager to admit defeat at the outset. So we're not quite there yet. And there's a lot of uncertainty as to what comes next.
And one of the reasons for the uncertainty right now is that this coming weekend, there are going to be elections in France and in Greece, two obviously key players in the European debt crisis. And maybe there will be a new focus on growth as opposed to austerity. Is that your sense going forward?
Definitely. That's the way that the political winds are blowing. We really are getting to where austerity is biting hard on these countries. And there's some political pushback against this.
Let me ask you this, because it does seem like this crisis tends to flare up every week and then it sort of dies down for a little bit and comes back. If the euro debt crisis is a 5K race, let's say, how far along are we, do you think?
You know, I think that the problem is that we just don't know. We don't know how long this race is. It's I know that we are all tired at this point and wish that we could take a break and that the finish line was close, but we just don't know whether it's a 5K race or a 10K race or a marathon.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
Sticking with this crucial Europe story now, some academics are saying that politicians and the news media are getting it wrong when they call the European mess a government or sovereign debt crisis. Let's go get a drink and explain.
Think about the Eurozone as a bar with a never-ending happy hour.
Boston University professor Vivian Schmidt, at a conference on Europe the other day, she said maybe the Greeks and the Spanish were on a drunken binge of borrowing.
But who were the bartenders? The French and the German banks. This is, in alcoholic terms, codependency. Everyone is responsible.
Because what's the duty of a good bartender when the customer's had too much?
Just say, hey, buddy, you've had enough, not today.
John Kariff's manning the bar at O'Neill's Pub near the UN in New York. If the customer insists on more drink, you cut him off by putting down a glass of water.
He'll eventually get the hint and just walk out. That's the best way in doing it. That's the way I always do it. Always seems to work.
I then asked Mark Blythe, the Brown University professor of political economy who convened the conference on Europe, about whether the region faces a drinking crisis, a government or sovereign debt crisis, or really a banking crisis. Blythe points to the mega size of European banks. He says they have a bigger footprint than banks do in the U.S. In France, the top three banks are 2.5 times bigger than the country's entire economy.
If any one of those goes down, it blows up France. Deutsche Bank in Germany has an asset footprint which is 80% of German GDP. And guess what? It turns out they were buying just as many silly mortgages as everyone else. Oh, and they bought all this debt from places like Greece, so their balance sheet is stuffed full of nonsense.
I thought our German friends were paragons of prudence.
They talk a good game of austerity for everyone else and then practice something quite different themselves. Their banks are stable because basically they have one big bank, which is Deutsche Bank. But in France, as I said, 260% of GDP, that's too big to bail. So why are we actually worried about the credit into these sovereigns? Why are we worried about the debt that they're carrying? Well, imagine that you can't bail them and you need to. Oh, and what makes this worse is they're all in the euro, which means they can't actually print their way out of trouble. So when you add all this together, then they kind of become liabilities and everyone's blaming the tired parent for the bad behavior of the teenager. But it's a private banking problem that we're really worried about.
Professor Mark Blythe at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. The conference was called The Failure of the Euro, with a question mark at the end of the title.
Well, I have a question for you, David. Do you think you would do your job better if there was a camera watching you?
I know there are microphones present.
Well, there's a company called AeroSight that thinks that cameras will make employees do their work better, and it has been helping other companies install cameras in the workplace to do just that. AeroSight started with meat producers, and it's now expanding into other areas. Adam Aronson is the company's founder and CEO, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, get specific. Tell me about what you've done with meat producers.
One of the large companies that we work with is JBS. It's the largest beef company in the world. They have some very important sanitation protocols that need to be followed. They installed our camera systems in their 8 facilities, looking at hundreds of workers following this process. And for protocol compliance that they thought was at nearly 100%, it actually wasn't at those levels when we first put the cameras in and started to do the observation. But within just a few short weeks, they were able to get their compliance rates up over 99.5%. They've sustained those rates for over a year, and in 2011, they reduced their E. coli rates by over 60% compared to the prior year.
Now, you've expanded into hospitals as well.
I never intended on getting into the healthcare industry, but I had some circumstances in my family. Both my mother and my sister got hospital-acquired infections about 7 years ago, and it really motivated me to bring the same services that we offer in the food industry into healthcare. And so we've worked with a group called North Shore LIJ Health System here in New York. They've taken our services, implemented them into one of their intensive care units, and were able to take hand-washing rates that they thought on their own were at about 60%. It turns out that they were down below 10%, but within 4 weeks of giving feedback straight to the units using electronic scoreboards right on the ICU walls, they were able to get their hand hygiene rates up over 85%.
Wow.
And that, in turn, had a significant impact on reducing MRSA transmission rates, which can cause hospital-acquired infections.
All this by just putting in video monitoring services, basically spying on the employees.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting misconception. You know, a lot of people say it's, you know, Big Brother. But what happens is that workers, for the most part, never get any feedback that's objective. In 10 years of doing this, we've never been removed from any plants. There's never been any employee unrest. And if anything, we constantly see units and hospitals or plants that are not using our services. They're requesting corporate management to get these services in.
Adam Aronson is the CEO of AeroSight. Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on today, Jeremy.
The Prime Minister of Japan, Yoshihiko Noda, is in Washington today for meetings with President Obama. There are tensions over the U.S. military in Japan, but moves toward closer cooperation on energy and trade. The BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo says it's about more trade, but not free trade. Mr. Burke, good morning.
Good morning.
We were following the story about negotiations between the U.S. and Japan over troop deployments in Asia. There is also an economic angle here, isn't there?
There is an economic angle. They're going to be talking not only about movement of 9,000 Marines from the southern Japanese island of Okinawa, but also trade. I think what they'd have liked to have done is announce that Japan will take part in the talks over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a big free trade area around the Pacific Rim. I don't think that's likely to happen, or at least I'm not going to hear an announcement probably. And that's because of domestic politics here in Japan. This marketplace is very protected, particularly people like farmers. There's massive tariffs on things like rice. Although the Japanese government would still like to do that, I think probably not a big announcement at this meeting.
Even in a world that seems to be defined by large free trading areas like there are in Europe, like there are in parts of Asia, and certainly NAFTA.
Yeah, the tariff on rice is more than 700%. But that does mean, too, that farmers are protected and they get to stay in their jobs. And they're certainly very vociferous if there's any question of those tariffs being pulled down. So it's a long process for the Japanese government to join a free trade area, even if it thinks it's a good idea for other industries.
The BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In the wake of last year's nuclear disaster that followed the earthquake and tsunami, the Japanese government is now preparing a massive bailout of TEPCO, the electric utility there. Bloomberg News reports this will likely follow the same plan used when the government had to bail out a big bank, Resona, 9 years ago.
Okay, now let me tell you why Barnes & Noble stock is up 76% at the recording of this podcast this morning. We found out that Microsoft is investing $300 million in Barnes & Noble's digital book business. As Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports, the two companies are teaming up as they struggle to compete with the Kindle and the iPad.
Microsoft is mortal enemies with Apple and Amazon, and it's hard to see your enemies win. Amazon introduced the Kindle 5 years ago, and people have been reading books on their iPads for 2 years. Now Microsoft decides it wants to get in on the action by investing in Barnes & Noble's Nook.
It's basically an accelerator for Microsoft to get into the book business.
Roger Kay is with Endpoint Technology Associates.
Barnes & Noble is arguably the only other possible partner for Microsoft here.
But the two companies are frenemies, to say the least. A few months ago, Microsoft was suing Barnes & Noble as part of the epic battle between the Windows and Android operating systems. But call it bygones.
It's sort of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The spat between Microsoft and Google is less important in this case than the spat between Microsoft and Apple and Amazon.
A big benefit of the deal is that it gives Microsoft an entry into the business of college textbooks, which can retail for more than $100 a piece. In its deal to invest in the Nook, Microsoft is hoping that strange bedfellows will translate into clear profits. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At Gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
The web company Shutterfly lets the world see if it's making money today. The startup was the hot place for printing digital photos, but is there anything hot about that business model now? Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
Shutterfly is a middleman, really. The website helps you turn your digital photos into prints, cards, or albums. It had more than 3 million customers last year. But the digital photo space is changing fast. More people are keeping their photos in their devices.
You see photos on people's iPads or their iPhones or their tablets.
Mark Evans does marketing for tech startups.
I don't know who prints photos anymore.
Companies focused on photo printing must compete for fewer and fewer clients, says Max Wolf with Greencrest Capital.
Clients that are not enormously loyal kind of look for the best deal each time.
Just because a family printed their baby's birth announcement with Shutterfly does not mean they'll use the site again for that first birthday album. I'm Eve Tro from Marketplace.
The New York City skyline could get a new king today. One World Trade Center is about to become the tallest building in the city. But is the surrounding neighborhood rebounding along with the skyline? Sally Herships has that story.
Sorry, Empire State Building, you had a good run. At least all this construction at One World Trade is good news for downtown Manhattan. That neighborhood is back, right?
Well, depends on what you mean by back.
Ken McCarthy works with commercial real estate firm Cushman & Wakefield. He says before September 11th, the financial industry took up half the neighborhood. Since then, some financial firms have moved uptown. But
the number of people living in Lower Manhattan has increased dramatically.
Old office buildings make nice residential spaces. Today, there are about 60,000 people living downtown. That's twice as many as a decade ago. And new kinds of commercial tenants have moved in, too.
Creative services, professional services, nonprofits.
Liz Berger is president of the Alliance for Downtown New York.
Everything from Condé Nast to Priceline to the William J. Clinton Foundation.
And a dozen new hotels, which means there's more room for tourists, another growing industry, to come and see the changes for themselves. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The global price of food is tied in crucial ways to soybean prices, and the cost of soybeans is now hitting levels not seen since just before the 2008 food crisis. When this happens, farmers switch to soybeans and away from rice, that crucial staple of diets in so many parts of the world. Jeremy Zwinger runs a commodity trade publication called The Rice Trader. Mr. Zwinger, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is driving higher soybean prices?
Well, probably the easy answer is oil. If you look at agriculture production, it always comes down to the cost per acre. And oil, of course, leads into gasoline, and gasoline leads into fertilizer. So it's all a related complex that comes together, and as costs go up, so the cost of soybeans.
Now, when soybeans go up, this has wider impact, I mean, really throughout the globe.
That's correct. I mean, if you go to higher prices in soybeans, usually you're going to start stealing acres, which is what we're seeing in the U.S. in rice, especially in Arkansas, which is the biggest rice-growing state. You've seen amazing amount of conversion from rice to soybeans.
I also saw a report that also part of the problem is dry weather in some of the soy-producing regions of Latin America.
That's correct. Brazil did have some major drought this year, and of course that's added back into the high Chinese demand. But interestingly, the drought in Brazil also affected their rice. So now you have a tight supply in South America for soybeans and rice, and a lower production for rice in the U.S., you're really setting up a regional shortfall.
Jeremy Zwinger, who runs a commodity trade publication called The Rice Trader, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
We all know about the incredible growth of the economy in China, from skyscrapers that go up in a couple of weeks to factory towns that are bigger than some U.S. cities. But they are also snapping up raw materials in China to help support all that growth. And the latest commodity that the Chinese want has a certain touch and feel. According to the Wall Street Journal, cotton has become part of the fabric of life in China. The country has bought over 1 million tons of the fluffy white stuff in the last 7 months.
Here to talk with us in our Midday Extra is Sharon Johnson, senior cotton analyst with Penson Futures. Good morning, Sharon.
Hi.
Give me a sense about why China has decided to invest quite so much in cotton in recent months.
Well, cotton is very important to the Chinese economy, particularly as it pertains to employment of not only its farmers, but for those who work in the cities and specifically inside the textile manufacturing facilities. China is the largest producer of cotton worldwide, but they consume a lot more cotton, so they have to import to make up the difference.
I've been doing the supply and demand calculation here. If they need a lot of ours, that could drive up the price of cotton here, right?
Well, it has certainly been a market factor. According to the USDA, in the latest monthly supply and demand report, world stocks are actually at a record level, and that is stocks of cotton worldwide. But because of China's insatiable appetite for cotton worldwide, not just from the U.S., but India and other exporting countries, it has proven to be very supportive of prices this particular crop year.
And what has happened to the price of cotton? Because I know in the last couple of years, it's had a pretty steady climb, right?
Well, that's true. In the fourth quarter of 2010 and first half of 2011, cotton prices pushed to all-time highs. We had never been as high as we went to, actually topping out above $2 approximately a year ago. And it just kind of came as a bit of a surprise. So the market went through this rationing process. And that's one of the reasons we have a record carryout this year, is because that record high price influenced a lot of producers worldwide to grow a lot more cotton at a time when the slowdown in the U.S. and European economies hit, which actually has reduced the demand for cotton and pushing manufacturers towards using either other natural fibers or man-made fibers, as the case may be.
So it's an interesting lesson, and you can have a large supply, but as long as demand is going up, the prices can stay pretty high.
Well, that's true. But in this case, again, using the USDA figures, ending stocks in China, and that is the amount of cotton available, or at least ways in stocks here at the end of the crop year, is approximately 35% of the world figure. So true available supplies is much, much smaller than the gross number put out by the USDA. And in the case of China, they're rebuilding their strategic reserves of cotton in a very meaningful fashion. And that cotton really won't be available to anyone, certainly not to mills outside their country and even their own mills, unless and when they decide to release some of that cotton in order to restrain prices.
So among the many things I've learned today is that there's not just a strategic petroleum reserve, that China has a strategic cotton reserve.
That's right.
Because I guess you can't run an economy unless you have a decent supply. Well, that's really, really interesting. Sharon Johnson, senior cotton analyst at Penson Futures, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Sometimes down-market hotels are described as cheap and cheerful, but what about cheap and sustainable? The group Brighter Planet has plowed through data on hotels nationwide and finds while there's room for improvement at all price levels, the budget hotel chains tend to be the greenest. I'm sure it's laundering all the fancy bathrobes at the upscale places that's holding them back, but Brighter Planet says smaller rooms can use less energy. If that's the equation, then some of those microscopic New York hotel rooms must be awfully sustainable.
And finally, to Stafford, Virginia, in one of the strangest shoplifting cases of all time, an 18-year-old dressed in a cow suit allegedly stole 26 gallons of milk from Walmart. According to the news website Inside Nova, he crawled out of the store on all fours with the milk and started handing it out to people.
Yeah, I just did the math, Jeremy. That is not a trivial undertaking. 26 gallons is like 223 pounds of milk.
Yeah, I don't understand how he... maybe he put... he balanced some sort of a thing on top of him that allowed him to carry all this milk.
Pulled it in a wagon. I don't know.
I know, exactly. However, all accounts do say that he did not move at any point during this alleged robbery. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.